Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the church sex abuse scandal in the wake of the grand jury report out of Pennsylvania. And then the Vigano testimony, the 11 pages of testimony that implicate the top reaches of the Catholic Church's hierarchy, including Pope Francis, particularly as it relates to Cardinal Theodore McCarrick and allegations, settlements of his systemic sexual abuse of seminarians over an extended period of time. Cardinal Supich in Chicago. Yeah. Also implicated, not in terms of being an abuser, let's be clear here, a lot of lines to be drawn, but in terms of being somebody who benefited from McCarrick. He was, according to the Vigano letter, elevated to Archbishop of Chicago, despite the fact that he wasn't one of the names referred to the Pope for that position. But McCarrick, behind the scenes, who was then working as an advisor to Pope Francis, moved Supich in Chicago, moved another individual in for the diocese in Newark, New Jersey. And this is after, again, according to Vigano, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis's predecessor, had disciplined and essentially sent to Siberia McCarrick. Francis brought him back. Had to know at the time. There were stories. There was too much public information. The hierarchy of the church had to know.
There were pictures of him. It was disgusting. They called him Uncle Ted, and he had befriended this kid in a family that he had become close with, and they had gone on trips when he was a kid to San Francisco, to different places, and what he did to him was disgusting. They detail the whole thing. Now they're pressing criminal charges. Probably statute of limitations is up, but they're still filing charges against him in those states and in Washington, D.C.
Supich conferred an award on McCarrick just 2 years ago. Oh. They scrubbed the video from the Archdiocesan website.
That's not a good sign.
Oops. Yeah. Supich and Francis both playing dumb. Francis saying he won't comment on the Vigano testimony. Supich finally sat down with Chicago media in the last 48 hours, Chicago Tonight, where he was lobbed a bunch of softballs from Ponce, of course. And Marian Ahern, NBC5, got this out of Supich, which was making the rounds yesterday, responding to, just the Pennsylvania grand jury report.
Right.
300 priests, 1,000 individuals over 70 years who were abused by clergy, and the curious case of McCarrick's staying power low these many years, despite what we knew publicly about him, at least in terms of the severity of the allegations serious enough, credible enough, that there were settlements more than a decade ago.
Yeah, he settled with a lot of seminarians who said that he harassed them, he groped them, and they all had the same story, that there was never any kissing or hand-holding involved, but there was other things for the private parts.
Here's Supich on Francis.
The Pope has a bigger agenda. He's got to get on with other things, of talking about the environment and protecting migrants and carrying on the work of the church. We're not going to go down a rabbit hole on this.
Not going down a rabbit hole. Bigger things to worry about, like junk science on climate, like Syrian refugees, sanctuary cities, Cardinal Supich. Bigger things to worry about, not going down a rabbit hole of a honest reckoning with the hundreds of millions of Catholics around the world? How about just the millions in Chicago? Not going to have a reckoning in terms of what happened. By the way, the Chicago Archdiocese, north of $140 million in settlements to date. $4.5 million in the McCormick case alone. Not going to go down that rabbit hole of an honest accounting. To tell me that doesn't sound like your typical politician, and Cardinal Supich is nothing if not political. And it turns out that's about all he is. There is nothing. Listening to Supich yesterday, it just struck me. There is nothing in Illinois. There is no institution in Illinois that has not been completely rendered illegitimate by politics, that is not thoroughly corrupt. And I'm sorry to say, as a Catholic, that that includes the Archdiocese of Chicago. Maybe not under Cardinal George, but this, I mean, in the wake of the Vigano letter,
there's no contrition. There's no remorse. They're like re-victimizing the victims.
Well, it's very interesting.
You know, we've got other things. Don't bother me with sexual abuse right now. I've got climate control.
Yeah. No, climate change. I need to go watch Inconvenient Truth again. I'm sorry, I don't have time for this.
I mean, he said that there's no secret files here in Chicago like there were in Pennsylvania. And Lisa Madigan said their new hotline, they've received 20 new tips.
But Cardinal Supich has...
Well, he claims that that's isn't that enough?
He's running interference for Pope Francis.
Yeah.
What's really going on here? That may be the case in Chicago.
That's why he came out when he did.
And
this is a distractor.
And here's how much he's running interference for Supich. Are you ready for his Father Flager impersonation?
Uh-oh.
Here's why people are going after Supich. I mean, after Francis, says Supich.
Quite frankly, they also don't like him because he's a Latino.
Oh.
So the...
I completely forgot that he was a Latino. Everybody's a Latino now.
The first refuge of the scoundrel, race baiting. Tell me he doesn't sound like a Chicago politician.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the rap that you hear from Supich on Francis than what you would hear from a Louis Gutierrez defending Tiny Dancer? Can you distinguish the two? Because I can't. It's disgusting. It's sad. Greg in Schaumburg.
What's really heartbreaking about this is that there are so many priests that work constantly and effort, you know, that they're just really, really good people. But Cardinal Supich's statements are just unbelievable to have made within the context of everything that is going on within the church. Namely, the fact that only about 21% of Catholics go to church anyway. And most of their parishes are really hurting financially. And this is not going to help matters at all.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Tom in Deer Park.
Yeah, good morning. I would echo that previous caller's comments about the excellent clergy, and we hurt for them because of the painting of the broad brush. But as far as Cardinal Supich, the way he handles things yesterday, it almost reminds me of when Harvey Weinstein had his bad day, and he said he's going to go off to retire and double down to go after the NRA.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how tone deaf that was yesterday. Supich put something out on Twitter having to do with capital punishment, and then he went back to the socialist progressive trope about climate change. So it's very it almost seems orchestrated, like they think that we're that stupid out here.
Well, it is.
Thanks
because
for the call, Tom.
You know, the files came out, and then McCarrick, and then Pope Francis made a statement, and then boom! I mean, within hours. Cardinal Supich is sitting down with every single news media outlet in Chicago.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a really good piece in the New York Times by Matthew Schmitz. Is there a Catholic Civil War coming?
Ooh.
And Schmitz, who writes for First Things normally, and the answer is there should be. George in Barrington.
You know, if Paterno lost his job, Francis has got to go. Francis, you ought to be dictator pope. This guy's been a disaster from liberation theology on. And the other part of it is, I don't know if he's really Latino. I know he's Italian. Italians are Latins, so I guess he is. But is Argentinian liberation theology is the problem.
Thanks for the call, George.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're often critical of the D.C. press corps for the stories they choose to report, the stories they don't, the way they choose to report them. But here, you know, you have to tip your cap when it's appropriate. And the Associated Press has this scoop. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I mean, after Labor Day, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings start, right?
Right.
So we need to know information about Brett Kavanaugh not contained in the hundreds of opinions he's written as a jurist.
Is he retired from coaching fifth and sixth grade girls basketball?
No, it's this delves back into his time at Yale.
Uh-oh.
And
is this going to be bad? Because I'm not in the mood for any bad news.
It's not bad. It's horrible.
Oh, he just wants to have dinner with his wife and no other women?
AP Politics reporting. Brace yourself.
Okay.
As a student at Yale in the 1980s, Brett Kavanaugh stayed out of debates on campus that was going through many of them, friends and acquaintances say. He seemed more interested in basketball.
Oh, my.
Obviously, it's disqualifying.
Hitting the hardwood, huh? Shooting the rock?
Instead of going to
campus debates, yeah.
Right, the LGBT rallies or whatever was going on at Yale, protesting Halloween costumes, he was...
Well, I think he should be disqualified.
Playing basketball?
Kavanaugh, you naughty boy.
I would... He was probably listening to rock and roll in his dorm room, too, rather than participating in those debates.
Wait, are you... That's
disgusting. That's, he's a monster.
That's all they could find on him?
I withdraw
any
my support.
Any unpaid parking tickets? Any bar fights? Any relationship problems? That's all they found.
I don't think you're hearing me. He resisted participating in the social justice zeitgeist on campus. Preferring basketball instead.
Oh.
Boy. Talk about a character flaw. all right, we'll stay on this story. We'll let you know what else Brett Kavanaugh may have cut in line at the cafeteria. We don't know, but AP is on it. So we'll keep you updated on this developing story. In other news, Jim Brown made some yesterday. Jim Brown was on Fox and Friends talking to Brian Kilmeade. Jim Brown, Amy. He's north of 80 years old. I think he's 82
oh,
years
he looks
old.
He great.
He does, and he's quite lucid, and he's got a lot to say. Obviously, Jim Brown has been a noted activist since he left his legendary career in professional football. And Kilmeade had him on to talk a little bit about his relationship with Trump and a little bit about racial politics. Here's Jim Brown describing his relationship with the president.
Well, I'll tell you, the greatest thing about America is that we all have our opinions and our thoughts. Nobody is totally correct in everything that they do. I have access to the president, and anytime I have access to the president and he will listen to my thoughts, that's all I can ask of him. And that's what I do. So this president is accessible, and he's different. He's challenging, and he pays attention to what I say.
And Jim Brown essentially suggesting, as you heard, look, if I can get an audience with the President of the United States and he'll take into consideration something I have to say, what more can I ask for? And he also, because Jim Brown is a guy who holds himself accountable, which so few do these days, particularly in the public eye, he talked about... what is happening on the ground, what I'm doing, the more I could be doing. And then I can talk to somebody in a position of power like the president to amplify good things that are being done by me or others in my community. Jim Brown on sort of taking up what was that famous Democrat's line about doing for your country rather than your country doing for you?
So I don't blame him and what his office can produce. I look at what I can produce in the black community and the community at large and all the individuals that I can influence that will work with us to make this a better country. So we should look at ourselves first before we look at the president. Well, I'll tell you, it's very hard to produce for the black community in a certain way. The black community, and I'm a part of the black community, has a responsibility regardless of what the president does. And if you have a homicide rate within your black community, then it's not the president that's created that homicide rate. It's the black community itself that needs to address it. So I don't want to just put everything on him. And I'm sorry to say that the black community is not doing what we should do, and that includes myself. I can work harder. I can donate more money. I can go more places. But we have to be able to, as citizens, bring something that the president can join forces with and triple the effectiveness of it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. You know, don't believe the president. Don't believe lily white pansies from Wheaton like me. Believe Jim Brown. What about Jim Brown, what he has to say? Something different than you hear amplified by the D.C. press corps, which is the Black Lives Matter grievance identity politics of the left, isn't it?
Yeah. Black Lives Matter. Honestly, I think it's a local terrorist group, Black Lives Matter. They're trying now to, did you know their new movement in Chicago, real quick, is to take Chicago police officers out of public schools? That's what they want to do. And,
well,
and I wanted to say to those
they've been given a
kiddies,
seat at the table.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter has
well,
been given a
problem.
Seat at the table.
And I want to say to those kiddies, do any of you have children? Do you know what's going on? I mean, not that, you know, you don't care if you don't have kids, but I have children in CPS, and every school should have armed officers. It just, that's in, at the high school level. And they do. Every school, even Walter Payton Prep, Lane Tech, wherever, has metal detectors to get through.
Have you watched this series yet that's Ooh, been launched one? On Starz, America to Me, about Oak Park River Forest High School? It's done by Steve James, the great documentarian who did Hoop Dreams and
yeah.
who sent his kids to Oak Park River Forest. He's a local.
I haven't watched it yet. Is it?
I saw the first episode yesterday. I think there's only a couple episodes out so far.
Yeah.
We're efforting him to get him on the show. But America to Me, by the way, is he? That's a phrase ripped from a Langston Hughes poem. The way that racial politics, race, diversity, the buzzword of the generation, is treated at OPRF is sort of jarring to see through the eyes of the few students that they kind of follow around.
Yeah, that they profiled.
To give perspective. Yeah. I mean, we know about what happened there with the blacks-only student
right.
assembly a couple years ago that sparked so much controversy. But to hear from the students' perspective and also to get the perspectives of additional administrators, it's rather revealing, just one episode I've seen so far, and it runs about 180 degrees counter to what Jim Brown is offering, as you heard, when he sat down with Brian Kilmeade at Fox.
So do these students feel discriminated against because of the color of their skin? I mean, is that the whole premise of the...
It's not the entire premise, but there's certainly, that's a strain that runs through the first episode, and I suspect it's going to run through the entire series. And remember, this is obviously leftist paradise, leftist utopia, right? This is an integrated leftist community with a high school, even though it's upper middle income, a high school that's majority white, but it's got about a quarter of the students are black mm-hmm. and about a tenth of the students are Latino and 3% are Asian. And, you know, watching the left apply their feel-good progressivism to classes like English literature is something to see. It's not the English literature class I took.
Are you surprised that they let the cameras in and let them do this? Because I know the principal and the assistant principal said absolutely not, and the school board's the one that said, no, we need to let them in.
Yeah, I think
if
it was...
If we're really going to be, you know, all-inclusive, we want to know exact, you know, all-encompassing, we need to see what's going on.
Superintendent and principal were opposed
yeah.
to the cameras, but yeah, the school board came over the top.
I think it'd be distracting if you're a student, too, you know.
In the first episode, I mean, you know, you get, I think...
I have to watch that.
you get a little bit of it. You know, it's hard to not know the camera's there. But I don't know. I think it's, first of all, there are interviews, so you get face to camera and people's thoughts, which is interesting. And then they're followed around a little bit. So, yeah, does it distort it a little bit? Maybe a little bit. But I think it's nonetheless fairly revealing. And so going back to Jim Brown and, you know, the charge of the day, Trump is a racist. Right. If you disagree with someone, then they're a racist. That's the left. Those the names they have to call. You're a misogynist, you're a homophobe, you're a racist. All of the isms and all of the phobias, that's all they have. Jim Brown has more. Jim Brown has more. And he answered that question about President Trump straight away.
Jim, do you look at this president, the times you've said one-on-one before and after him being president, is he a racist?
I'm so glad you asked me that. Of course not. You know, is America racist? Of course not. The emancipation, the advancement of black people in this country is based upon white people who risk their lives just to do the right thing to make the playing field equal and balanced. So we always talk about the negative, but what about the positive? How many black athletes are millionaires because of those fans, white fans that go to those games? The NBA, the National Football League, those organizations would be out of business if it were not for people of, not of color, but white people that go to those games and support those teams. So we have to give credit to the positive aspect of what people are doing in America and stop going to the negative first.
Uh-oh. Boy, you know, it's easy to label conservatives, and it's easy for black politicians to go after the likes of Republican or conservative politicians, pundits, authors. How about going after Jim Brown? See, because it's not, Jim Brown is not just a legendary athlete. I mean, he's got 40 years of social activism, 40 years of working with gangs to try and curb violence, 40 years of working in neighborhoods and the streets to not just present a better path, but also to get those kids on that better path. So you want to, what's Jim Brown? Is he an Uncle Tom? Which of the Black Lives Matter bedwetters, which, you know, dandy Hollywood actor or a professional pamper professional athlete like Cuba loving Colin Kaepernick want to go after Jim Brown? Love to hear it. By the way, Jim Brown, speaking of athletes and the bedwetters and pampered, Jim Brown on the NFL, since the season is upon us, respecting the flag and respecting the anthem.
We should never denigrate our flag and our national anthem. We should always be Americans first, and we should work our butts off to do the right thing and make it a better country. But to not respect your flag and your national anthem is something that I would never do.
Yeah, Jim Brown, unfortunately, a bygone generation that produced great leaders and intellects. Great athletes, yeah. Great leaders, Jim Brown. Great intellects, Thomas Sowell, Walter Williams, Bob Woodson, Shelby Steele, so many more that don't get the profile that they deserve, don't get amplified the way they should because they're not part of the Hate America First group. But boy, I'd love to let Jim Brown's comments seep out into the body politic and those political organizations we discussed and prompt a reaction. Love for some enterprising reporters to pick up Jim Brown's comments and put them right to the Spike Lees of the world and all those who are given profile, the Michael Eric Dysons of the world. Love to see Dyson versus Jim Brown on CNN. How about that rather than Candace Owens? How about somebody who's lived a life and proven up? That's Jim Brown.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Oh, Nelly.
Oh, Nelly.
Nelly Orr, that is. Apologies to the late, great Keith Jackson. It turns out Nelly Orr has a problem. Either her husband is lying or her boss is lying or both of them are lying. This takeaway from Bruce Orr's closed-door testimony on the Hill yesterday, 8 hours worth of it. Washington Examiner reporting that what Bruce Orr, number four at Justice, wife Nellie works for Fusion GPS, right?
Right.
That's the firm that created the Trump dossier, unverified Trump dossier. And Bruce Orr was acting as a cutout to Christopher Steele, the British spy hired by Fusion GPS to compile the unverified dossier. Christopher Steele was dispatched from the FBI so that Christopher Steele could still communicate information back to the FBI that had broken off their relationship. Okay. All right.
Okay. All right.
It became very clear there are a number of factual conflicts, said Congressman Matt Gaetz. Either Bruce Orr is lying or Glenn Simpson's lying. Who do you choose if you're Nelly Orr? Whoa! Nelly, who do you choose? Is it hubby or boss?
Well, which can give me more bang for my buck? I'm going to go with the boss.
Yeah, it's out the door. I'm going where the money is.
Sorry. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, lady's got to eat, gotta take care of herself.
You get it both ways then. You keep your job, and then when you get divorced, I mean, you're still entitled to half the estate and half of this pension and all that.
To keep the car. And, yeah.
Absolutely. Mark Meadows, who's the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus and a member of the committee that to which Bruce Orr appeared yesterday, he previewed some of what they were going to discuss with Bruce Orr, questions they wanted answers to. So did Daryl Issa, outgoing Republican congressman from California. Here's Issa.
Well, we want him to confirm what we already know from hard evidence, that he and his wife were part of a conspiracy to, in fact, create this narrative of involvement and wrongdoing by the president relative to the Russians. So we have a lot of evidence. Now the question is, can we get him to confirm the evidence, or will he deny the truth right before us in writing?
And then Mark Meadows explained the lines of questioning they were going to pursue with Orr.
There are three different lines of questioning. One, Congressman Issa talked about it. Will Bruce Orr verify what we already know? One of the interesting things is that we have evidence that would suggest that FBI informants were told that there was no collusion, and yet it seemed to be ignored. So we're going to ask Bruce Orr about that. Additionally, when you have Christopher Steele and Nelly Orr being paid tens of thousands and in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars to put forth a false dossier, why would they rely so much on those two witnesses and ignore others? So there's about 60 plus questions that I have. Hopefully we'll get some truth, be able to report back to you. But, we're looking to honestly have a full day of questioning here.
And 8 hours is a full day. The interesting thing, too, is here's another guy who allegedly, according to Republicans on the Hill, provided the dossier to the FBI. I mean, how many people gave the FBI this dossier?
I don't know.
You have allegations that McCain was involved in doing that. Bruce Orr was involved in doing that. John Brennan is the one who instigated a lot of. It's interesting. There's
a lot of cooks in the kitchen there.
Well, and there's a whole host of people who wanted to take credit for spurring the investigation. Do they still? Bruce Orr still want to wave that flag? Mark Meadows. Also, interestingly, made an overture for the declassification of documents, which a number of editorial boards and other pundits and some members of Congress now, including Mark Meadows, have been calling on the president to do.
Really, your viewers, the American people that need to be the judges of this. I believe that we need to have complete transparency, take some of the documents that we've been able to see, declassify them, allow the American people to see it. And when they see it, they will be appalled at what happened within our FBI and DOJ. It should never happen in a constitutional republic.
I'd like to see him. So, the criticism that Trump will get from the Adam Schiffs of the world notwithstanding, documents that would inform and perhaps be dispositive of some of the questions the American people have and some of the fact-free allegations that are going back and forth, I think would be really helpful. I think whatever legitimately can be declassified without compromising assets in the field and national security, all the obvious concerns, I think they should be released and should be released post haste, because here again, Mark Meadows set off a bit of a firestorm before Bruce Orr's testimony yesterday when he alleged that, he alleged this.
I believe they did. We know that some people at the Department of Justice and FBI actually gave information to the media. Then the stories were reported. Then they used those reports to justify further investigations. You know, that's like saying, well, we're going to incriminate one on one hand and be the jury on the other. It just doesn't work that way.
So here again, we have the media folded into the story, much like the Michael Cohen story and Lanny Davis as a source or not a source or sometimes a source, or Meadows alleging. So the FBI feeds information to the press. Then they use those articles, and we know this from the IG's report. They use those news articles as part of their rationale for the FISA warrant they obtained from a FISA court.
It's so corrupt. But who is the leaker from the FBI giving information to the media?
Well, I mean, we know Andy McCabe admitted to leaking, but that was supposedly at the with the approval of Jim Comey, and Jim Comey says no. So yeah, this
Comey gave some information to his old professor. Right?
So this den of thieves is sort of collapsing in on itself. It'd be fun to get them all in one room. One week of testimony with all of the entire cast of characters in this melodrama in one room, rather than, well, I guess this is better, after we've had them individually and they've run into conflicts with their cohorts, to be generous. Co-conspirators is another term you could use. Lindsey Graham was on Fox and Friends yesterday, talking a little bit about this in advance of Orr's testimony. And I remember Lindsey Graham, like Trey Gowdy, somebody that was deferential to Bob Mueller and the special counsel, getting less and less so.
Word of caution to the public. A lot of people have tried to convict President Trump. Don't be so fast. I've seen no evidence of collusion after 2 years. Mueller's looking at it. We'll see what he says. Plenty of corruption. The Department of Justice and the FBI should be stunning. Not one Democrat seems to care. Reverse the roles.
What corruption? What do you mean?
Well, okay, just imagine if the Republican Party hired a foreign agent to go to Russia to get dirt on Hillary Clinton, and they used it to get a warrant and never told the court about it. It'd be front page story everywhere. That's pretty corrupt when the two FBI agent and the U.S. attorney, DOJ lawyer, it's our job to stop Trump. Can you imagine what would happen if it's our job to stop Clinton?
Thankfully, we don't have to imagine that.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And a MAGA hat landed one 17-year-old high school senior in cuffs, Amy.
Oh, really?
This comes to us out Sacramento way in sunny California. Union Mine High School student is facing battery charges after an altercation in her classroom over a Donald Trump Make America Great Again hat. A cell phone video, of course, caught some of this because what is a high school classroom today without every kid having a cell phone to video anything that may transpire.
Because everybody wants to be a star on YouTube or on Instagram.
Here's what happened. The local CBS affiliate reporting on young Rachel Butler, not a Trump fan.
Video shows some of the tension inside this high school classroom. The teacher trying to subdue a fired up 17-year-old senior, Joanne Butler, hurling curse words after she became enraged at a classmate for wearing a President Trump Make America Great Again hat and grabbed it off his head.
That's a racist and hateful symbol.
Joanne Butler is now facing two counts of battery, one against her classmate and another against her teacher, who deputies say she slapped as he escorted her out of the room. Butler says she made the scene to express her political beliefs.
Maybe just wake people up in some type of way, because it's not cool, the environment that our classroom is in.
Yeah, Joanne.
The social justice warrior.
It's not cool, the environment in our classroom isn't right, because you got snot-nosed 17-year-olds hitting people and slapping their teachers. You know what I mean, Joanne? About the environment in the classroom? You know, you got people that are intolerant of somebody expressing their viewpoint in clothing, and they can't restrain themselves. Creates for a hostile classroom environment. You know what I mean, Joanne? Here's Joanne's dad on the topic and the incident.
It wasn't handled the way I'd like it.
Her father is now facing the legal impact of his daughter's now alleged criminal act, centered on the political divide across the country.
Well, I don't agree with, you know, grabbing someone's hat and verbally talking to him that way. But as far as the issue being brought up, that maybe this is something that needs to be not just...
Yeah, needs to be discussed.
What's he going to do to her at home?
Did not say. It's apparently he's not happy with the altercation, but he agrees with her perspective. I mean,
Well, that's when you got to step in as a parent and say, you know what, I know that you don't agree with your classmates politically, but don't touch anybody. Keep your hands to yourself. It's real simple. Things you learn in kindergarten.
Or he could just not bail her out.
Oh, you keep her in?
She was arrested. Too bad. Exactly. He could tell. He could tell the prosecutors to throw the book at her.
Or you'd be like, who's that girl? I don't know. Is she's my daughter? What? No, I don't know about her. Yeah.
Joanne Butler.
Play
no,
dumb?
Different
no,
Butler.
Never
not
met
related.
Her. Never met her. Yeah, but she should be kicked out of school, don't you think, or suspended?
Well, it did happen on school grounds.
Right.
It would be interesting to see what disciplinary action.
Oh,
the
she'll probably
takes.
Be Hilda Hero. She might even be prom queen or homecoming queen.
Now, part of this, irrespective of the hat, how about just the way people dress in public school? How about uniforms?
I loved you. We used to have uniforms at Blaine, and they got rid of them, and I died a little inside.
I mean,
it's
again,
a lot more money. For the moms.
I go back to this America to Me series that just launched about OPRF.
What were the you
first
seeing?
The first thing that strikes me is you know, not the racial politics and all that nonsense, is the way the kids dress.
Really? What did you see? Like midriffs or?
No, it's not even that it was that it's not even it was racy dressing. It's just slovenly. the kids are just dressed slovenly. Just you know,
tuck the shirt in.
Yeah,
or, like low pants.
All the you know the garish T-shirts and shorts and shorts. Like what is this? Honestly, there is a certain order that uniforms bring.
Was there a lot of yoga pants and activewear, or more grunge? Or I
mean, no, not as much of that. I mean, again, it
I
wasn't
think all high school students look scary. I mean, I've been high school shopping, and no matter where I went, they're just scary looking.
No, they,
and then
they,
getting your kids no, tattoos look, at 17 is...
They look like hobos, except for... Does anybody use that word anymore? Except they have expensive headphones on, the Beats headphones.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's the accessory. That's the new jewelry. I'm not kidding you. That's what they wear.
Otherwise, they look like they're getting ready to hop a freight train to the Pacific Northwest or something.
So is grunge back? Like plaid?
It's not grunge. It's just. I don't know. It's just you know.
Mike Scott
misfit
has
clothing.
You have high school age students, don't you? What do you let your kids wear to school? I mean, father of four.
I have two in college, one in high school, one in seventh grade.
Well, what do they wear to school? in high school.
What did they wear?
Yeah.
Oh, it depends.
Make them dress up?
Yeah. We never allow them to look like crap when they go out of the house.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. Wow, that's an aggressive.
Never. But that's, no, absolutely not. No.
Hair comb, teeth brushed.
Peter will wear khakis and a button down to school.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's how it should be.
It's kind of different, but that's just who he is. Never holes, never ratty shoes.
It's his style. It's his jam.
There should be uniforms. I mean, I really.
I don't disagree with that.
After watching the OPRF thing, and then I'll, and I'm not because of this MAGA hat thing, because this, you know, this right. hysterical girl slapped a kid because she's wearing a MAGA hat. That's just stupid. But I mean, just hats, phones, all that stuff's gone.
I know
that stuff is no place.
How many people are on their phones? I mean, I went to DePaul Prep. They're doing everything on iPads. There's no more textbooks. They're on iPads. But then you can log on to other things. And everybody's on their phone, even between classes. People are listening to music in between. We couldn't do that. We couldn't get our Walkman out in between class and start
Walkman,
listening to music.
Walkman? How old are you? Oh, my God.
At least I had a Discman. No, I didn't.
Oh. Holy cow.
Oh, you didn't have you had a Walkman and a boombox?
No, I graduated before Walkmans. I'm just letting you know.
I had somebody who followed me around with a boombox playing my theme music.
That sounds just like
what I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was. Now what I'm with isn't it, and what's it seems weird and scary to me. It'll happen to you.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Don't miss David Clark and James O'Keefe at Freedom Summit 2018. Get your tickets today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and Cardinal Supich. In the last 24 hours, sitting down with members of the Chicago Press Corps to respond to the allegations against Pope Francis in this 11-page letter that was penned by Vigano, who is a former nuncio, Vatican, part of the church's hierarchy. For many years, respected George Weigel, good piece about Vigano, Archbishop Vigano in First Things. First, Archbishop Vigano is a courageous reformer who was moved out of the Vatican by his immediate superiors because he was determined to confront financial corruption in the administration of the Vatican City-State. Second, Archbishop Vigano is, in my experience, an honest man. Third, Archbishop Vigano is a loyal churchman of a certain generation and formation bred to a genuine piety about the papacy. It's important to get somebody as respected in the Catholic circles as Weigel to opine on Vigano because it's very interesting to see what's happening in the wake of his letter. And this against the backdrop of the Pennsylvania grand jury report, which is the press corps running interference for Pope Francis. Remarkable. Running interference with respect to an institution that did not properly, preemptively address the horrors that were occurring within it with respect to sex abuse. And I point to this Reuters piece yesterday. Defenders rally around the Pope, fear conservatives are escalating the war against Pope Francis with respect to those calling him to step down.
Oh, please.
We disagree with Pope Francis, don't like his forays into topics of which he knows very little. Labor economics, climate science. However, I wouldn't be saying he should resign over that.
No.
But people are saying he should resign over his apparent treatment of a known predator in Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, as outlined in Vigano's testimony. That's a different thing. And it's not only the left-wing press that's rallying around Pope Francis. It's also the beneficiaries, again, according to Vigano's testimony, of McCarrick and Pope Francis, like our own cardinal here for the Chicago Archdiocese, Blaise Supich. Supich sitting down yesterday with NBC5's Marian Ahern, and listen to what he says about the allegations lodged against Francis.
The Pope has a bigger agenda. He's got to get on with other things, of talking about the environment and protecting migrants and carrying on the work of the church. We're not going to go down a rabbit hole on this.
I mean, that is so offensive on a number of levels. His number one priority should be dealing with this issue and coming forward and saying, look, we made a mistake. Because I want to know if he knew about what was going on and if he just is ignoring it or it was part of the cover-up. I mean, we have a right to know. And I'm not even Catholic, but I'm horrified for the victims.
I'm Catholic, and I am as well. And, oh, by the way, I mean, the rabbit hole of systemic sexual abuse that occurred in the church. It's a remarkable way, a remarkable dismissal of something so existentially serious as this. And if Cardinal Supich, since he's full Alice in Wonderland on climate science like Pope Francis, you may want to check out Bjorn Lomborg's piece in the New York Post, excuse me, today about actual scientists and what they found about the things over which you obsess, the rabbit holes you go down at the expense of the issues you should be confronting. And if you think that's bad, the first refuge of the scoundrel, we see it all the time in Chicago politics. What is it? Race hustling, race baiting. I've lost the debate. I don't want to confront the issue. So you know what I'm going to say? You're a racist.
Quite frankly, they also don't like him because he's a Latino.
Oh, so he's saying we Americans, Catholics, we don't like Pope Francis because he's a Latino?
He's saying conservatives, critics of Pope Francis, the real thing going on here is race-related. Because we don't subscribe to climate change theories that Supich and Francis subscribe to, and because Pope Francis is Argentinian, that's what's really going on here.
I don't even see when I look at Pope Francis. Nobody even knows. Nobody even cares.
The quality of the response from Supich should tell you, in my view, a lot about the veracity of what Archbishop Vigano had to say in his testimony. That those responses tell me, which I already believed, Vigano's telling the truth. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Kurt Martens. He's a professor of canon law at the Catholic University of America and also the editor of The Jurist. Dr. Martens, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what of these pieces coming out today? I mentioned the Reuters piece about fears that conservatives are escalating some war against Pope Francis. Matthew Schmitz in the New York Times writing about the possibility of a coming Catholic civil war. The treatment that the Vigano testimony is receiving and what you think the church's response should be.
Well, that's a whole lot of quite a number of questions that I need to answer right now. Let's stick to what is essential, and that is the abuse crisis and the care for the victims. Let's put that on the first place. What to think about all of this? I do think that we will need a thorough investigation, and we will have to look into the mechanisms that led to this cover-up that was found in the Pennsylvania grand jury report, but also the whole McCarrick case. Who knew what when? I think that is the big question. And as Bishop Vigano's testimony is, of course, an important and interesting letter, however, it raises also a number of questions, and I think it's a good starting point to look into what is going on. All the other things about being pro-Francis or against Francis are, I think, not relevant. We need to get to the truth of this matter, because this crisis, I think, in my humble opinion, is worse than 2002 because it's more a systemic crisis. We're looking at the exercise of power in the church. We're looking at how that power is controlled, not. And we're looking at ways of controlling that power, that exercise of ecclesiastical power by bishops in the first place. And I think this is a big challenge we are facing. But before we can solve that problem, we need to know first what happened. And that's why I said, with regard to McCarrick, we need to know who knew what and when.
Well, but it seems that you knew what and when. I mean, he had settlements with people in the seminary who he allegedly harassed, and I just don't understand why he was allowed to be in this position of power for so many years.
Well, Your question is the same as mine. I don't understand that either. Apparently, there are reports out there that state that some people have informed the Holy See prior to his going to Washington, or later or not. We need to know about that. And more in particular, we need to know who was informed and why was it then that he could still go up the ranks.
Right. And so actually, I mean, so I understand the kind of the statement of principle. We need to have serious questions provided.
Absolutely.
Serious answers. However, that necessarily includes Pope Francis. And so the discussion of Pope Francis, his handling, what he knew, his future, to me, is completely relevant. And if they wanted to try and turn this into a political discussion or an ideological discussion, then we can have that, too. We can confront that straight away. But Pope Francis's response that you've seen to the media, that you've seen the Vigano letter, and you can make up your own determinations, I'm not going to say a word about it, that doesn't wash. That's not acceptable. And he necessarily has to engage if we're going to get to the truth, doesn't he?
I do think so. I was highly surprised when I saw that answer. However, we all should not be surprised when Pope Francis answers questions these days, because he has his own typical style, which is different than the style from his predecessors. That being said, I do think we need some answers, and pretty quickly. If he believes that Vigano didn't tell the truth, he needs to say that. But we need to know what the role is of Pope Francis in this whole crisis. Do the people in Rome, including Pope Francis, get it? In other words, do they realize how serious the sexual abuse crisis is, and that do they realize, one of the reasons why I said it is a systemic crisis is, if we do not address this, then it's going to hurt the credibility of the church on other matters of importance, right to life issues, etc., for instance, to name just one. How can we speak credibly about that if we do not address, if we do not protect the most vulnerable that are entrusted to us? I think that is the key issue. And I think Pope Francis will have to give answers about his handling of cases. And he has a little bit of a stormy record when it comes to handling sexual abuse cases.
What's your response? You just heard Cardinal Supich say, you know, the conservatives don't like Pope Francis because he's a Latino. What do you think about him playing the race card as, you know, a way of running interference and taking, you know, deflecting from the real situation here?
Well, who am I to judge? I think that is not answering the question. I understand all those remarks, but quite frankly, we have to look at actions and at the content, and I don't think we should. I think we should have the answers to the questions and not deflect from the question.
Okay. All right. Well, that's an answer. Dr. Kurt Martins, professor of canon law at the Catholic University of America, also the editor of The Jurist. Dr. Martins, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Thanks.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'll take a couple calls in response to our discussion with Catholic University professor Kurt Martins about Supich's comments, Francis's comments, and the failure to reckon with the sex abuse that occurred in the Catholic Church for so long. By the way, I mean, at some point we're going to have to talk about where this all began and how this metastasized. And that will necessarily include some difficult discussions, because only 3% of the cases of abuse are pedophilic in nature.
Just 3%?
Most of them were post-pubescent men. So there's this other thing going on, predatory behavior that was allowed to metastasize. And it does have something to do with the political ideology that took hold in the church and the church hierarchy. John and Palatine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Thankfully, I didn't experience this, although I went to Catholic parochial schools on the south side. We just had our garden variety alcoholics. But
sure,
the way they're handling this situation, which is horrible, the way they're not dealing with it or addressing it, is it just even proves that there's a cover-up occurring at the highest levels, and I don't know why justice isn't being meted out. If it were a police or a fireman or a teacher, there would be jail sentences and capital punishment.
Not in CPS. Thanks for the call, John. Pete in Montgomery.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. So one of the other systemic problems here is it's a sexual event. And if I'm not mistaken, Catholic priests take a vow of celibacy. So why are we talking about priest predators or sexually active priests when they should have been defrocked and removed to begin with?
Great call. Great point, Pete. Thanks for that. That's where I was getting to, and we'll get to that more later.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Jason Van Dyke, the former Chicago police officer who is about to stand trial for murdering Laquan McDonald, speaks for the first time since that fatal shooting.
Yeah, he sat down with a few reporters from the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, what you learn is that he prays every day for the McDonald's family. He says that he offers up a rosary every day. And that also, when asked, he said that he's worried the verdict could lead to riots, saying, quote, "I'm very scared for it. It's obviously weighs heavy upon my mind."
He also says, I'm quoting Jason Van Dyke, "I might be looking at the possibility of spending the rest of my life in prison for doing my job as I was trained as a Chicago police officer, being away from my family every day." He gets emotional, the Tribune reports. The Tribune also suggests that Van Dyke signaled what will likely be another key part of his defense, repeating several times that he had never before fired his gun while working mostly nights in Chicago's most dangerous neighborhoods during more than a dozen years on the force. Jason Van Dyke telling the Tribune, "Any loss of life was extremely difficult. It's something you try to mentally prepare yourself for just in case. You don't ever want to shoot your gun. It doesn't matter if it's to put down a stray animal or something like that. Nobody wants to shoot their gun. I never would have fired my gun if I didn't think my life was in jeopardy or another citizen's life was. It is something you have to live with forever." And he called that night the darkest day of his life.
Yeah, he said that he remembers coming home, quote, "I remember coming home and just sitting down in the shower until the water went cold, and even then I couldn't get out."
"Everyone wants to be part of the bandwagon of hatred," said Van Dyke. "Anyone who knows me personally, knows that I'm not a racist. That's a great false narrative. It's just slander." He talks about the political pressure. He still says he still considers himself a great police officer during his 12 years on the job. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you have to look at this in context and be fair. Reverend Marvin Hunter, representing the McDonald family, McDonald's mother, Tina Hunter, said, "I don't know the man. Is he really praying or is he just saying what he thinks you want to hear? They're trying to write a narrative. They're trying to influence the jury. I'm not mad or surprised because it's just legal maneuvers. If I were writing the script for him, I would have said exactly what he's saying." Right. So I don't pretend to know what's in Jason Van Dyke's head or heart. You can only go with what he said, but certainly the timing of it shortly before his murder trial is scheduled to begin.
Yeah, jury selection begins next week already.
Right. So you do have to have a little bit of skepticism when it comes to this. Understand there is a legal strategy being employed. There's nothing wrong with that, but let's just not be Pollyannish about it, that's all. For a reaction to what Van Dyke had to say in advance of this trial, we've talked about this with him before, but now it's here. We're pleased to be joined again by Kevin Graham, who's the president of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police. Kevin, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think about what Van Dyke had to say and about his decision to grant the Tribune this interview with this timing?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. First of all, they had done a jury study, and that 85% of Cook County residents had already made up their mind as to his guilt or innocence. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why I believe that this is coming out at this time. I think he has to get out some sort of statement so that people don't walk into that jury room with a preconceived notion. I heard you talking with Amy a little while ago about whether or not he's actually praying for the family. I can tell you on a personal note, because Jason does work at FOP, mm-hmm. I have found him, I have seen him in this building praying. So okay. If anybody believes that's not true, it certainly is. He certainly is religious. I have... I can say that he personally is done his best to be a good Catholic, and I think that this does affect him very seriously. So people who are skeptical about that are flat out wrong.
He's told the Tribune, he said the Tribune, because they asked about the shooting, they wouldn't get into details. His attorney stopped it, but he said that under Illinois law, police officers can use any force necessary to defend themselves or another from bodily harm. You know, is that
from great bodily harm?
From great bodily harm. So, do you think that if they follow the letter of the law, that it will be on his side?
I think if they look at all the facts, they look at the totality of the circumstances and the law. I do think he'll be found not guilty. What has been missed in this is the fact that we were understaffed, both in patrol and in supervision. When a taser was called for, there wasn't one available. At what point does the city have to accept some of the responsibility for that occurred? I think Jason did do what he was trained to do. I think the explanation for the 16 shots is going to come out during the trial. I think he does have a good defense. And I believe that he will be found innocent, and I believe that, people have to wait until the trial occurs and he gets his day in court.
Now, and this is, you know, 4 years old now, this case, and the Tribune does in its story about the Van Dyke interview recount some of the details from that night. There's been a lot of rumors about what may not have been reported yet, what may or may not come out on trial, and that may, you know, be additionally incendiary in an already sort of tense environment in Chicago with respect to race relations and the populace versus the police and the political demagoguery and all of those factors. One of the rumors I would like you to address is this idea that there is chatter on the radio that the public has not been made aware of yet, something that Van Dyke may have said of a racial nature. Is there any truth to that? Do you know anything about that chatter? That's something that may come out at trial?
I know nothing about that. I would find that very skeptical.
Okay.
But certainly I've heard nothing. I know people would like to make this a racial incident, but it's not. It has to do with an individual who had a knife in his hand, refused to comply with the lawful orders of the police, and that's what happened.
And prior to that, though, didn't he slash the police car's tires and use the knife on a windshield?
Yes.
Yes, yes, that is all true. You know, I think one of the things they may be talking about in terms of radio calls is what the initial call was, because I think that brings into light what occurs. Now, I have not heard it, and I'm not going to comment on what I believe it occurs, but my understanding is that it's very it supports the officer in the frame of mind in which he came to the call. So that might be what people are talking about, because it certainly was a dangerous situation. I do believe this is a very dangerous job. Police officers have to make split-second decisions. And nationwide, police officers shoot about 400 people a year across the country. Out of that 400, 61% of that 61% of those people that are shot by the police are male white.
Right. Yes. Inconvenient statistics for the political environment in Chicago, no question. A question about the other three officers, including Van Dyke's partner. They're also awaiting trial. People may have forgotten this for obstruction of justice and other charges. And is the if Van Dyke is found, if he's acquitted, the impact on the other three, do you see the charges against the other three officers as sort of fruit of the poisonous tree of a wrongful prosecution of Van Dyke?
I do. I think they're going to be found not guilty, whether it goes to trial or not. But if Jason is found not guilty, I would guess that the charges are going to be dropped against them as well, because I think that they will prove that the officers did not lie, and we're not trying to obstruct justice.
What allegedly did they do?
And I understand that, but that's why we try and do our best to get the right facts out as quickly as possible. Obviously, if additional evidence comes up later, then we take that into account. But I think people do their very best at giving accurate statements and accurate reports when these things occur.
Just switching gears, a more global conversation about violence in Chicago streets after all of the response to the violent weekend, the Lollapalooza weekend. And the violence, of course, hasn't subsided much since then, but you can only hold so many press conferences if you're the mayor, I suppose. I wonder, with the changes that were announced by Superintendent Johnson and the mayor after that weekend, more officers being deployed to the four districts where much of the violence is occurring. Those changes announced, have they translated to the streets? So what has been the actual substantive outcome of all of the press coverage of Lollapalooza weekend and the changes that the administration announced?
You know what, we haven't been studying those. We know that the shootings are less than that weekend, but whenever you have whether it's 75 or you have 30 shootings in a weekend, that's too many. We certainly want to be engaged with the city in trying to solve those problems. But as of right now, we're certainly trying our best to work on as many cases as possible. Right now, Jason is our focus this week, but I think that it's a little too late. I mean, the city should have come to us a long time ago to try and work out these problems.
Now, do you think if he's acquitted that there will be riots on the streets of Chicago?
No. I think part of the job of myself and other people, particularly politicians in this city, is they should look at the rule of law, and they should be backing up the police. Part of the problem that we have in the violence here is that people are not backing the police. And that's where they need to start changing their tune. They need to support the police, realizing that the police are doing a very difficult job and that they should be supporting them, not trying to have more oversight on them, because that's going to lead to more crime. Because police officers are not going to want to go out there if every time they turn around, they've got somebody watching over their shoulder and criticizing everything they do.
Right, like not using the right gender identity pronoun, which is a real problem in the city.
Yes.
Here's the thing, though, too. You know, on this topic of riots, depending on the verdict, you know, one of the things is just always remarkable to me is we all in Chicago, the quote unquote leadership, civilian political leadership, sort of concedes it. You know, when Eddie Johnson said most of the violence is contained in four districts, what does that mean? What is he, George Kennan? We're following a policy of containment with violence in the city of Chicago. And it's the same thing here. Oh, there's going to be riots. There's going to be riots. Where are the civilian political authorities saying, no, there's not going to be riots because the rule of law is going to be enforced regardless of the outcome, regardless of whether the verdict is a verdict you agree with or not. We're not doing L.A. redux. That's not going to happen. And just understand, people, Chicago families, that it won't be tolerated. It's almost like they kind of, well, you know, let's hope for the best, because if this goes the wrong way, there's going to be riots. Like, we're hapless and there's nothing we can do about it.
You know, you're exactly right. The rule of law does need to be applied. We need to have law and order. I think the next whoever is going to be the next mayor of this city is going to have to realize that law and order is the only way that people are going to tolerate living in this city and their political leaders. There should not be riots. I'm expecting Jason to be acquitted. Other political leaders in this city should be standing up and saying there should never be a riot. This is a court of law, and he will have his day in court, and that they expect that people of the city of Chicago will adhere to a peaceful acceptance of whatever the verdict is.
All right.
Certainly nobody is saying that there's going to be a riot if he's found guilty. So I think that people who want to have a riot because if he's found not guilty are people that simply just don't want to obey the law and don't want to adhere to the rule of law.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, that you're right. The message should be either way. We're not going to have any celebratory violence, and we're not going to have any, you know, violence because you're disgruntled, you're upset with the verdict. We've seen it happen both ways in other cities. He's Kevin Graham. He's the president of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy take a couple calls in reaction to our interview with Chicago FOP President Kevin Graham as we're nearing the murder trial of former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, who gave an interview in the Tribune this morning. Verlon on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Now, I tried to give you all a break from my annoying voice, but this right here, you know, it got my fire burning again.
All right.
Listen, Dan, I will never call this man a racist. You know, I don't like you throwing the racist term around. I've always said it was blue versus black for all of these decades. I try to take each case by case, okay? I do believe he's praying, but I believe he's praying for Jesus to come save his sorry butt. 16 shots. That man was literally smoking on the ground from bullets riveting in his body, okay? There's no way this guy is going to beat this case. If he does, I'm sorry to tell you, you don't argue with the liberals on the weekends like I do. I listen to what they say. They're calling for this city to go up in flames, and I believe it's going to happen if this guy doesn't get convicted. Nobody's going to get past the fact that he used excessive force. 16 shots, Dan.
Yeah.
How many shots does it take to put him down?
Well, he was on PCP, Verlin, and from what I was told by one of my sources, that he kept shooting, and his body was still moving. That's why he kept shooting, and his body was frolicking around,
Amy,
and fidgeting
you,
because
he was on PCP. I love you, Amy, but once you're on the ground, after about fifth or sixth shot, after you're on the ground, there's no reason to keep on shooting him.
Mm-hmm. Well, would it be fine? And would it be justified if he shot him just twice instead of 16 times?
He could have shot him six times. But after you hit the ground, it's a done deal, Amy.
Yeah, there is the question, though, Verlin, of overcharging him. First degree murder is the charge, but so we'll see if the jury wants to go first degree murder, premeditated, meaning
he got up in the morning and decided to kill somebody.
I've always said they overcharge. I don't think first degree murder, because you cannot prove that he woke up in the morning and said, I'm going out to kill somebody. That they can never prove.
Right. As far as we know, we don't know all the evidence that'll be presented, but that's what we know in terms of what's publicly available at this point. But appreciate it as always, Verlin. We don't find your voice annoying. We find it mellifluous. Please call again.
Thanks,
Verlin.
And that's the word of the day.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
I'm Sean from Elmwood Park. I'm in for Joe Walsh all week, if you can believe it. Tune in when Freedom Fights Fabian Socialism at 5 p.m.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And can we just, before we get into the particulars of new NAFTA or what's...
Ustma? United States-Mexican trade agreement.
It's elegant. It's really elegant. Yeah. Or a trade force, as Steve N88 calls it. This dissertation from Don Boudreau over at Cafe Hayek is really good, just in terms of making the philosophical case for free trade, just so we kind of set a foundation from which we should be building policy. Do you believe women should be unconditionally free to trade with men? Do you?
Yes.
Right. It's so simple. Do you instead suppose that because some women's trade with men works and some such trade doesn't work, you're silly and ideologically intoxicated if you insist that women nevertheless should be unconditionally free to trade with men? He's bringing the debate down to the micro level, the individual level, because this is what some trade works and some trade doesn't. And he's essentially assailing that position. Boudreau writes, I believe Americans should be unconditionally free to trade with non-Americans for the same reason that you believe that women should be unconditionally free to trade with men, that brown-eyed people should be unconditionally free to trade with blue-eyed people, that Catholics should be unconditionally free to trade with Lutherans, and that people who live west of the Mississippi should be unconditionally free to trade with people who live east of the Mississippi. Because a person's political citizenship is as economically irrelevant as is a person's sex, eye color, and religion. It is no more than an extreme corner solution to endorse unconditional free trade among people with different passports than it is to endorse unconditional free trade among people with different chromosomes. Free trade. So, you know, thinking about that and through the eye of the consumer, as we're instructed by Bastiat and others properly, is this free trade, new NAFTA? NAFTA wasn't really free trade because it doesn't take 1,200 pages to write what Don Boudreau wrote and to take that position as a country policy position. And so new NAFTA, at least the piece of it that's been negotiated with Mexico, 75% of a car has to be made in either the U.S. or Mexico to avoid tariffs. That's opposed to the previous 62.5%. Some 40 to 45% of that content has to be made by workers earning at least $16 an hour, which, of course, would shift some production back to the U.S., but it would also raise the price of cars for U.S. consumers, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. And I don't want that.
So is this markedly different than the deal that President Trump said was a scam that he inherited, that was a terrible deal? Is this just a gradation of the same? For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Good morning. So Canada's come to town to discuss what the U.S. and Mexico have agreed to in principle. But what about my overarching question? What U.S. and Mexico agreed to in principle, is this markedly different than NAFTA? How is this so much a better deal than the previous regime under which we were operating?
I'm going to give that a big no comment.
Okay. Okay. There you go. That's an answer. Yeah.
No, but, you know, really, I mean, it is kind of interesting. I watched the president's press conference when this was announced. And by the way, for those who watched it, it was kind of interesting because the Mexican president was, was on the telescreen. And, I mean, Trump was acting like, you know, if he had been there in person, I think Trump would have slapped him with a big wet kiss.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, this is not substantially different from NAFTA. That's the answer to the question. And, you know, so we have replaced the worst trade deal in the history of civilization with something that looks a lot like what we had before, but dare not call it NAFTA. Trump has declared that we're not going to call this NAFTA anymore. We're going to call it the U.S.-Mexico bilateral trade deal, which is much, much better than what we had before, although
yes,
it's not that much different from what we had
so
before.
Much.
But look, you're bearing the lead here, guys. I mean, this is good news that we've got this trade deal with Mexico, because number one, it means we need to have trade with Mexico for all the reasons you just said, and also it helps stabilize the Mexican economy. We don't want Mexico to go the way of Venezuela, for sure. If you think we got a border problem now, wait till they go to the left. But
true.
I don't think they're going to. But also, this tightens the other thing that's really interesting about this. If you had asked me 6 months ago, Nanini, you know, are we going to get a trade deal with Mexico before we get one with China? I mean, with Canada? I would have said, no way. And yet that's where we are. And this tightens the screws on Canada. I think Canada is now going to have to come hat in hand and make a deal with Trump because they don't want to be that odd man out here.
Well, what do the Canadians want from us?
Well, the Canadians, you know, I've talked to Bob Lighthizer, who is the U.S. trade rep, and look, they have elected a pretty left-wing government with Trudeau, and their U.S. trade, their Canadian trade rep is a woman, Christine Freeland. I used to debate her all the time on CNBC. She's a pretty dedicated left-winger. So they keep bringing up issues like they don't think that our state should have right-to-work laws because those violate the NAFTA agreement, and she wants to talk about transgender bathrooms, and she wants to talk about climate change and things that are completely irrelevant to free trade between two countries. And that's been a problem. The other problem, Amy, is that, let's face it, Trudeau and Trump are not exactly bosom buddies. Mm-hmm. And that makes it real. I mean, there's a personality conflict between the two, and that's complicated things. But the other thing Trump brought up in the press conference that he had a couple of days ago, he said, you know, Canada has these high tariffs on American agriculture, and in many cases he's right, so we got to bring those down.
Yeah, or you're going to get hit with a 25% tariff on your cars, is what he essentially intimated.
So how is
that? Yeah, look, I don't like that. Let me be very clear. Yes. They just wrote a study on this. I think auto tariffs are a really bad idea. For one thing, they don't even really protect American jobs because so many of the cars that we build in the United States are built with foreign, auto parts and so on. And so this would make the manufacturing cars in the United States more expensive and make them less competitive. We could actually end up losing more jobs, Dan, with these auto tariffs than we would gain.
So is this deal making your buddy Larry Kudlow pull out what remaining hair he has?
Look, Larry is Larry's at the center of a lot of this, although he's not. I mean, I think Lighthizer is the most important one because he actually understands this trade law. And you're right. You know, when you mentioned how many pages was NAFTA, something like 1,200 pages.
Yeah. It was easy.
You've got to be a lawyer with 14 degrees to understand this stuff. I mean, it's these trade laws are extremely complicated. And you're right. Why does that? If we're going to have free trade, why does that require 1,000 pages of rules and regulations and legalese that nobody can understand? So, but look, Larry has been a very healthy influence. Our goal is to get Trump to zero tariff with some of these countries. And I think at the end of the day,
yes,
I think we're actually going to have freer trade than we did before. It's just Trump is forcing these other countries to lower their tariffs against us, and I'm all for that.
Well, how will this agreement with Mexico benefit farmers? Because President Trump was saying, I told him I'd help them out. How is this helping them out?
Well, they've agreed in principle in a handshake that the Mexicans are going to buy more U.S., soybeans and wheat and cotton and corn and
right,
things of that nature. Now, whether they, follow through with that promise, we will see. But they've also promised to lower a bit their tariffs. Look, even with NAFTA, they didn't, there were still tariffs. And so this lowers those tariffs a bit, and we'll see what kind of a difference that makes.
I want to get your reaction to this because I know this is a particular topic of interest to you. It is to me, and it doesn't get the attention it deserves, which is why I'm appreciative that the Wall Street Journal opined on it. Can you explain to me and Amy and our audience why it is that Democrats don't want minorities to start their own businesses? And, of course, I'm referring to Democrat Governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, who vetoed legislation that would have removed licensing rules for hair braiders in New Jersey, licensing rules that require hair braiders to complete 1,200 hours of training that can cost up to $17,000 to become a braider.
Dan,
yeah,
come on, Dan. You don't want amateurs doing hair braiding here. Come on. But, what are you talking about?
Right,
at
least
1,200 hours.
No question. By comparison, the minimum requirement to take the check ride to be a licensed pilot, private pilot, 40 hours. 1,200 hours to be a hair braider.
Yeah, my hero, of course, as you know, Dan and Amy, was the great Milton Friedman from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And Milton Friedman, in his great book, if people want a good last-minute summer read, read his great book that was written in the 1950s called Capitalism and Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an extreme position. Milton Friedman didn't even think you needed a medical degree to practice medicine. So if you don't need a medical degree to do a practice medicine, do you really need a degree to do basket weaving or hair you know, the hair styling and all of these other things. This has become a big issue in a lot of states and a lot of cities, and the Wall Street Journal had it right. The people who are victimized by these occupational licensing requirements are minorities who are more likely to go into these positions. And what is the purpose of those licensing agreements? It's not to protect the consumers. You know that, Amy, you know that. The reason that they have these licensing requirements is to keep people out of the industry, to reduce competition and increase the cost. And, you know, now we have this, by the way, is there any movement in Chicago? Because there's a big movement in New York and in Washington, D.C. to restrict Uber and Lyft drivers.
Yeah.
And that's because the taxi cab industry and the public transit agencies don't want people using Lyft and Uber. They want them, you know, using the licensing. And so this is anti-freedom. It's anti-growth. And let's make a crusade to get rid of these crazy licensing agreements.
He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
You too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, headless corpse found in fish tank in the hope of missing San Francisco man.
Did the fish live?
The
tank was empty except for the body parts.
Brian Egg's corpse swims with Luca Brasi.
You shouldn't laugh.
What do you call a headless
go.
Torso in a fish tank?
What?
Bob.
Oh!
Thanks very much.
Don't you dare get me in trouble again.
Brian Egg's corpse also, or torso, I should also, considering a run for Congress in San Francisco. Thank you very much.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And, of course, after Labor Day, we've got the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the Supreme Court. We also have a September 5th Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on social media and Russian meddling, at which Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, Facebook's COO Sheryl Sandberg are planning to testify. Not Google's Sundar Pichai, though, who's the billionaire CEO of Google now, tabbed by Sergey and Larry over there at Google, you know, to run that company. Now that Eric Schmidt's over at Alphabet and the whole thing.
Oh, my gosh. But my head spin.
Well, it is. There's a lot of head spinning there. And what's making President Trump's head spin is the allegation that Google, in addition to these other big online media companies, are whitewashing conservatives, are cooking the search engines for negative stories about President Trump.
Right. He accuses Google of rigging the searches and the results against him. He called it a serious situation that will be addressed. And he said in a tweet that the tech giant search engine had rigged news stories results to show mostly bad stories about him and other conservatives. So he was, you know, talking about himself, but also defending conservatives.
I think Google is really taking advantage of a lot of people, and I think that's a very serious thing, and it's a very serious charge. So I think that Google and Twitter and Facebook, they're really treading on very, very troubled territory, and they have to be careful.
They have to be careful. A shot across the bow from the president, Larry Kudlow, one of his chief economic advisors, was asked about that yesterday as well. Here's what Larry had to say.
What are you looking into specifically?
We're just doing some investigation and some analysis.
Is there any evidence that they actually are censoring anyone's search results?
We're looking into it.
Looking into it. There is some evidence that has been called together. A media research center released a study how online media companies are suppressing conservative speech. This you can find at newsbusters.org. They talk about some of what we've seen before and what we've reported on this show, like Project Veritas's undercover interviews with various engineers at Twitter. You just had Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, say the other week that, yes, I I can see that most of our employees lean left. Yes. Grand admission. But they go through, does Media Research Center, the fact liberal Twitter's liberal Twitter advisors outnumber conservatives 12 to 1. 12 of the 25 U.S. members of Twitter's Trust and Safety Council. That doesn't sound too Orwellian.
Trust and Safety Council.
Which helps guide its policies are liberal, only one's a conservative. Anti-conservative groups like GLAAD, gay rights organization, Anti-Defamation League are part of the board. There is no well-known conservative group represented. Tech companies rely on anti-conservative fact checkers. Facebook and Google both had partnered with fact-checking organizations in order to combat quote-unquote fake news. Facebook's short-lived disputer, Facebook's short-lived disputed flagger program had allowed Snopes and PolitiFact and ABC News to discern what is and is not real news. Google's fact-checkers accused conservative sources of making claims that did not appear in their articles and disproportionately fact-check conservative sources. So they have some recommendations for tech companies, sort of in the line of free market solutions. So very much like the suit that Prager University has filed against YouTube,
right,
and Google, by extension, its parent company. Contract dispute. Because remember, there's no First Amendment right to tweet or to use a private communication channel like Twitter or Facebook. This is not a First Amendment issue. You could say, and you could make the case, that they're violating their terms of use agreements with their customers. That's a different story. You could have a legitimate contract dispute there. Also, just in terms of more evidence before we get to the pertinent question, Paula Bolliard over at PJ Media did a little experiment, performed a Google search for Trump using the search engine's news tab and analyzed the results using Cheryl Atkinson's media bias chart of media organizations. Cheryl Atkinson, the investigative reporter we talk to frequently.
Yes.
Bolliard reports, I expected to see some skewing of the results based on my experience with Google, but I was not prepared for the blatant prioritization of left-leaning and anti-Trump media outlets. Looking at the first page of search results, I discovered CNN was the big winner, scoring two of the first 10 results. Other left-leaning sites that appeared on the first page were CBS, The Atlantic, CNBC, The New Yorker, Politico, Reuters, and USA Today. Not a single right-leaning site appeared on the first page of search results. So is that just a matter of the respective traffic, or is that a matter of cooking the search engines to rig it, as Trump alleged, against conservative news sites or any news site that has a an article that's complimentary or even handed?
Right, but how do they decide what goes on top? What's the first thing that pops up? I mean, I'm just Googling you now, and I don't like what I'm hearing.
Is that right? What?
What? This behavior, Mr. Prof, is very concerning.
Dan Prof,
I didn't know you had another side job.
Oh, really?
As a dancer.
Oh, is that right? Sad, geez, freaking.
I knew you were hanging out with Mayor Emanuel too much.
Freaking Google.
No, but I mean, all right, so you Googled, you know, all right, I Googled myself after I Googled you. Your shows all your Twitter. It's all your tweets. Uh-huh. And then your Google images is a picture of you, and then there's a picture of Brendan Riley.
Oh, from my Twitter war with Brendan Riley.
Yes. So that's on page two.
The difference
of yours.
And I won that war in part because only one of us was sober.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And it wasn't the alderman
from the boss bar.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, so the first thing that pops up is the Chicago Tribune article that they wrote about this is not my Me Too moment in regards to the sheriff from Lake County.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just like, why? How did that get there?
You know, well, they have
decides
algorithms.
Okay.
Right. But the question is, are they cooking the algorithms to,
right,
which they can easily manipulate, to try and marginalize conservative content? That's what some evidence suggests, and these looks at it suggest. The question is, let's say they are doing that. Other than a contract dispute, which would be a private civil action, do you think this is an area for a government regulation? Should the federal government come in and set the terms of operation in any material way for Google or Facebook or Twitter any more than they should for CBS or NBC or ABC News or any particular outlet? If Facebook wants to eliminate conservative content, flag it as hateful or whatever they do. If or YouTube wants to take down Prager videos, if Twitter wants to shadow ban conservatives, other than in violation of terms of use agreements, which is a not honoring a contract, which is actionable, is there other federal regulation that you would support to sort of mandate essentially equal time? And remember, that's what the left wanted to do to talk radio. Equal time. Air America couldn't compete in terms of drawing an audience. So we want equal time. We want to force you to have Janine Garofalo on your airwaves, force you to have Al Franken on your airwaves. Conservatives recoiled at that. They were right to. And I recoil at the suggestion that we should regulate Google or Facebook or Twitter and the content choices that they make. Private companies. If you don't like it, conservatives need to do a better job of building their own infrastructure. It's the same conversation we have with Andrew Klavan about Hollywood. Conservatives need to do a better job of driving talented writers into being screenwriters, talented artists into acting and directing and producing. You need to have more people that are courageous and talented to put their talent to use in a courageous manner. That's how a free society should work, in my view. But I'm willing to entertain others. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Bill in the South Loop. Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys. Good morning. I just wanted to say that whenever someone signs up for Facebook or Twitter or whatever, they have a reasonable expectation that their posts or whatever they put up is going to be seen by their followers or their friends. But if they're working behind the scenes to prevent that, that's just plain old fraud, you know?
Well, this goes again to say, here's the terms of use. Are you violating the terms of use? Then I have a claim against you as a user slash customer. And since, on Facebook, for example, you are the product, then perhaps you would have a claim, the same kind of claim that Prager University is lodging against YouTube. But the question is,
exactly.
But the question is federal government coming in and setting the terms of operation for these companies. And I'm not saying that Kudlow or Trump are suggesting that's what they want to do, but they're leaving it open to interpretation at this point, trying to, as I said, set a shot across the bow of these companies.
No, the government should not get involved. Everyone has the right to speak, but no one has the right to be heard. You can't confuse those two.
There you go. Well said, Bill. Thanks for the call. That's exactly it.
I'm still going through your Google.
Damn, what else did you find out?
I don't know if you want to. I mean, I don't know if I should tell you.
I was acquitted.
I didn't do it.
That part of my life is over.
I'm going to look at you differently now.
Paul in St. Charles.
Hey, good morning, guys. How you doing?
Morning.
Hey, you know, I just get a little tired of the Republican, you know, line bags about this whole thing. I mean, start up a competitive, you know, offering to Google and to Bing or whoever else is out there and build your own search engine that'll get you the results you want. I mean, it's a free market. You know, is it fair? No, not necessarily, but nobody's stopping any conservatives from rallying together and create a search engine that's going to play the same games that the left might be playing. So
yeah, I think
stop whining. That's my point.
I think that's fair. Thanks for the call, Paul.
Idea, conservative search engine.
Well, I mean, again, talk radio would be the counter to what we're talking about with online media companies. Talk radio is dominated by conservatives. Mm-hmm. So would you, if you want the federal government to come in and regulate social media companies on the content basis, you know, licensing basis, obviously FCC, public airwaves, you have to get FCC licensure. But if you want them to regulate essentially the government to act as an editor for these companies, then would you want the same for talk radio? I wouldn't. Doug in Waukegan.
Good morning. I agree with you, Dan, that they shouldn't necessarily go through and regulate on an individual basis. But, and you touched on in your last comment, when you equated broadcasters to the internet broadcasters have to go through the licensing process.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a certain limited avenue for appeal. You can file objections and protest to the FCC with that sort of thing, as was done with a couple of the networks when they were being creative in their interpretation of certain news events in the past. So do I necessarily want to see them licensed? No, I wish there was something we could do, but short of that, and it's an incredibly easily misused tool, I don't see that we could. So therefore, you know, take what we got.
All right, thanks for the call, Doug. Sean in Elmwood Park.
Is this the
You know what I'm loving? Republicans, they cannot apply principles, the same principles, to different topics. Conservatives can. We spent a year and a half fighting for the properly fighting for the right of a baker to not bake a cake for people he didn't like for no other reason. And as far as reasonable
that's actually a mischaracterization of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, but go ahead.
Okay, why? The two homosexuals who went in there holding hands and wanted a cake the way they wanted it had a reasonable expectation to get the cake. We argued, rightfully so, that the guy who actually makes the cake doesn't have to make the cake.
Yeah,
well, what was the argument about?
Yeah, so it was a religious liberty case. It was a First Amendment case, which is why it made it to the Supreme Court. It wasn't, I don't...
You mean beliefs?
Excuse me.
You mean beliefs?
Excuse me. It was a religious liberty First Amendment case. And so what you're talking about here wouldn't be a First Amendment case because there is no First Amendment right to post on Twitter, Google, or, you know, post on Twitter, Facebook, access Google. That's the difference.
It's applying the beliefs of the owners in one form or another. You like to apply it to God. I don't care about that. I'm applying it to beliefs because the belief structure of a socialist is far different of the people who believe in freedom. Now, if you really believe in freedom, you believe in the freedom of the socialist. The socialist can say, I don't want you on my business, in my business. I'm not going to service you. That's his right. We as conservatives are supposed to have the principles to even apply it to the scumbag lowlifes we hate.
Yeah, that's right.
So don't use Google.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the same principle, and it's the same principle with everything. I heard your interview with Stephen Moore, and I heard him backpedal. No comment. Why no comment? Because we can't say it's not right for Obama to dictate the rules of the world any more than it's right for Trump.
Yeah.
The problem is we've lost our way, and we attach it to popularity. Makes us no better than them.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Sean. You need to listen to both halves of an interview or a conversation rather than just the one half that you want to exploit, because that's what Stephen Moore said. Stephen Moore characterized new NAFTA as sort of a shadow of old NAFTA in the conversation.
I don't know if I like very calm Sean.
Well, Sean just needs to hear what somebody is actually saying rather than just stick with his cut and paste position that he will not get off of no matter what evidence is presented, no matter what argument is offered in response. And thus he melds constitutional arguments with sort of philosophical ones. And we can contrast and compare, but you have to listen in order to do that. So maybe he'll do better filling in for Joe Walsh than he did today.
Yeah, programming note, he'll be on from 5 to 7 all week.
Right, so from 5 to 7 today, you can have Sean not listen to you.
No, God! No, God, please, no! 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 No!
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So next week, jury selection begins in the Jason Van Dyke trial, the former Chicago police officer who shot and killed Laquan McDonald. And remember that the judge has withheld his decision on the motion to change the venue out of Cook County until after jury selection. So that's still a open question. And we talked to the FOP president, Kevin Graham, at the top of the 7 o'clock hour about this interview Jason Van Dyke gave to the Chicago Tribune, published today. First time he's talked about the shooting since it occurred 4 years ago.
Yeah, and what he said that, you know, he talked about that night. He came home. the magnitude of what happened. Quote, I remember coming home and just sitting down in the shower until the water went cold, and even then I couldn't get out. And he went on to say that he prays every day for McDonald's family, and he's a devout Catholic, and he says, I offer up a rosary every day.
He also said he considers himself to have been a good cop. The 12 years he was on the Chicago Police Force, never discharged his weapon except in the incident with Laquan McDonald, where, of course, he infamously shot him 16 times when his fellow officers on the scene did not open fire. And that is going to be, I assume, part of the case in chief presented by the prosecution for the jury. And by the way, just even talking about the jury, the decision by Van Dyke and his legal team to go with a jury trial as opposed to a bench trial.
Yeah, that was precarious. But I think the judge, they realized that they might be better off with a jury rather than one man deciding.
It's interesting because that's clearly what they decided. Right. And it says something about the confidence in Cook County Circuit Court judge, the ability of a Cook County Circuit Court judge, perhaps just this one or maybe in general, to not succumb to political pressure, to make a ruling based on the facts and the law, as opposed to going along with where obviously the majority opinion is in Cook County on the matter of Van Dyke's guilt. This is something that they've surveyed.
Right. They've surveyed it. What they found out is that 85% of those surveyed said they've already made a decision about guilt or innocence in this case.
And this was part of the petition presented for change of venue, which, as I said, the judge will make a determination on after jury selection next week. For more on this topic, somebody else who lived through a police-involved shooting, pleased to be joined again by our friend Brian Warner, who is the president of the Police Survivors Network, former Chicago police officer. Brian, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. How are you guys?
Good. You wanted to comment on the Jason Van Dyke case.
I did. First of all, we can't, you know, have any falsehoods that this isn't a calculated move by the defense. I mean,
right.
the narrative they're trying to get out there is certainly an important one. The city's had over 4 years to get their narrative out there. The city at this point needs Jason to be convicted because of the everybody's concern of a riot. And they're doing everything they can to not back the officer who did nothing wrong. Had they done the right thing right away and presented the facts of the case instead of burying it, and the reason they buried it, we all know, is because it was election year. Emilio Alvarez at the time and Rahm Emanuel were both in the midst of a heavy election.
Well,
they had to bury it.
Explain your perspective as a former Chicago police officer on the what you just said, which is he did nothing wrong, because people see the video, of course. They see Laquan McDonald shot 16 times, and they say that's excessive force at minimum. Maybe he should have never even fired. Certainly he didn't need to shoot him 16 times, and thus he is guilty of something. Maybe it's not premeditated murder. Maybe it's manslaughter, but he's guilty of something. You say Van Dyke did nothing wrong. Explain.
Well, he had every right to fire. I mean, the training, the law says anybody can shoot the person. The person's armed with a knife and has refused many numerous lawful orders by Jason and other officers to drop the knife. So he's an armed offender who, with a knife, Jason has every legal right to fire. His training teaches him to continue to fire until the threat is eliminated. After he fires the first several shots, when you're in the midst of a shooting like that, you get tunnel vision, your adrenaline goes up highest that your body can produce, and you do get caught up in the moment. But he continues to fire. I assume, I don't know this for a fact, but he's firing and assuming he's missing because Laquan is high on PCP, and he's not reacting to the shots that are hitting him. So that the first four or five shots, you may think he's missing because you're caught up in the moment. So he continues to fire. As far as firing when he's still on the ground, you're trained to continue to fire in the academy. They teach you fire until the threat is eliminated.
And that shooting took 15 seconds. Right.
I mean, this all happened in a matter of 15 seconds.
Now,
so Jason goes to do a tactical reload. His partner says, hold on, you're caught up in this. Let's reassess. He tells Jason to stop, and he goes over and he kicks the knife out. Once the knife is kicked out of his hand, that is when the threat is totally eliminated. As soon as that knife, I mean, you can throw a knife at somebody from laying on the ground. So that's going to be part of the defense as well. He is taught. You want to talk about retraining officers and when they can shoot and then de-escalation? We can do all that. But you cannot prosecute Jason and ruin the rest of his life and take the father away from the children because you taught him to do these things or you trained him to do these things and the law says he can do them. Because of politics and because of emotion, we cannot ruin his life or ruin his life any more than it already is by sending him to prison.
I want to ask you about it and remind our audience of what happened to you in your situation. You were in a police car and you just put somebody under arrest.
Right, and that's it, too. We've talked about it. No officer leaves their home any time and says, gosh, I hope I get in a shooting today. It just does not happen. I mean, and the officers that I've spoke with, there's a thing called the officer-involved shooting class at the academy that you're required to go to if you discharge your weapon, whether it be to kill an animal or you fire an offender and miss, you're still required to go to this class. And in the class, there's a few components. If the survivors group is there talking about the resources we have, there's an element of post-traumatic stress. So that's going to be there. Some have it severe, some have it a little bit, but you're going to have some form of post-traumatic stress after an incident like that. But then the other component they talk about is the spiritual aspect of it, the difference between murder and killing. I carry the guilt as a Catholic, as Jason does it, about Catholic, of having to take a life. And our chaplain, Father Dan Brandt, has a presentation talking about the difference between murdering and killing, and that put me at ease. But what I carry with me primarily now is survivor's guilt. Obviously, that I'm shot in the back in close proximity without wearing a bulletproof vest, and I'm still here to talk about it.
But it's
an emotion and something that I'm sure Jason carries having to take that life, but I'm hoping that he's coming to grips with it, and I'm 100% certain that he's not lying and telling you he's saying these prayers when he's not. I know him personally, and I know he's carrying that guilt.
Brian, tell us what happened in your incident, the shooting in which you were involved, you were just describing.
We arrested a panhandler of all things, and he was handcuffed behind his back in the backseat of our uncaged squad car, and he was able to produce a gun and fire on us inside the squad car. I mean, we had to bail out of the moving car, and he continued to fire at the busy intersection of Chicago Wells at 5 in the evening in the height of the rush hour, and there was a gunfight right there in the intersection. And again, I get emotional just thinking about it. And it's any police officer that's gone through something like this, people don't realize, that the poor officer that had to shoot the barber. We've talked about that. This is a young kid just out of the academy who did his job, did everything that was expected of him, did to his training and everything. But still, people watch that video and are going to crucify him and prosecute him before anybody even has the true facts. That's another curious thing to me. Everyone can get everything they need from one grainy black and white dark video and make the decisions that they need on the Jason Van Dyke case because that's what they want to see. But yet, with the other case with the barber, they had a whole different perspective. They needed the audio. They needed this angle. They needed everything else because it wasn't what they wanted to see.
Right. Now, does so Jason...
I'm sorry.
No, sorry. Has Jason Van Dyke watched... Has he seen the video?
I'm sure he has. And it's unfortunate because, I mean, it's part of the investigation that I was forced to watch the video. And I recommend when I go to the officer involved shooting class and I tell the officers, I said, if you have to watch it once or twice because of the investigation and testifying and whatnot, I said, but don't make a habit of watching it. I overwatched it and it really weighed on me because I analyzed it. It's still emotional.
What do you think Chicago police, in conjunction with Chicago's political authority, should be doing and saying in advance of this trial, if anything?
Well, there was another high-profile shooting, and the state's attorney's office did this wonderful presentation, did all the facts, went out there and showed. I mean, it's probably too late now because of the trial. I mean, and he's been charged, but he should have never been charged. But now they should be asking for calm. They should be starting all the relationships they have with the ministers and everybody out and with boots on the ground in these communities where a lot of the upheaval will happen. You have to get to those people and say, hey, this is what really happened. If you're angry with it, there's a process to go and change laws and change training. But there's a possibility, once the facts are presented and the law is explained, that he's going to be acquitted. as awful as it looks, and the optics of it, it's factual, and it's our legal process, and we cannot just discard that and destroy our city because of it.
He is Brian.
I know that's a difficult thing to present, yeah. But it's going to have to start happening soon.
He is Brian Warner. He's the president of the Police Survivors Network, former Chicago police officer. Brian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your perspective.
Thanks, guys. Have a wonderful day. Keep law enforcement in your prayers.
Will do. Thanks, Brian. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.